All this week, we're reporting on email. Today, email and the law. One incriminating message can spell a big loss for a company involved in a lawsuit. On the other hand, a company that can't produce a key email in court could be even worse off. What's a business to do? NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
If you're thinking about enrolling in law school, listen up. Ken Withers is director of judicial education at a legal think tank called the Sedona Conference.
Today, a young person graduating from law school and joining a large firm in one of our major cities can look forward to perhaps 3 or 4 years of doing nothing but sitting in front of a computer screen reviewing email and other electronic documents for litigation.
This is the modern legal landscape, where by some estimates, more than 90% of the cost of a lawsuit can come from sifting through emails and other electronic documents. Withers says in the old days, maybe 20 years ago, a case that involved 300,000 pieces of paper was considered huge.
That's considered a drop in the bucket today. The equivalent of 30 million or 300 million pieces of paper, if these were printed out, would not be unusual.
That may seem daunting, but it does carry an advantage. Electronic documents are much more searchable than paper documents. In fact, some companies now have proactive filters that can catch troublesome emails before anybody files a lawsuit. Cindy Launchbaugh is with ARMA International, a nonprofit association that deals with records management.
For instance, in the financial industry, one example might be the word guarantee. You know, guarantee a return of something. They're not going to put the company on the line for something like that because it can't uphold it. And it could come back and bite them later, obviously.
So if the word guarantee pops up in a company email, someone might check to make sure employees aren't promising something that they can't deliver. But many companies aren't that organized. ARMA co-sponsored a study last year that found 1 in 4 American companies does not have a system for organizing electronic documents. That system might tell companies what they keep, what they get rid of, and how to archive things if they need to go back and find a document in a lawsuit. But if a business without a system gets sued, it can cost a fortune.
It can get into the millions.
Dave McDermott is a records manager for J.R. Simplot, an agribusiness company based in Idaho that does have a records management policy. Simplot created that policy because 40 years ago, federal investigators came asking for documents.
And we didn't manage our information. Our records were stored in horse barns.
McDermott suspects many companies only get on the electronic records management bandwagon after they've been sued once. Today, a massive company the size of Simplot may juggle 300 or 400 court cases at a time. Each case requires its own set of documents that has to be retrieved and sorted. The industry calls it production. When a company that does not manage its email gets sued, McDermott says,
many cases are settled because the cost of production outweighs the cost of settling.
In other words, when a company has to choose between spending millions of dollars on sorting email and spending a few hundred thousand to settle a case, they may just pay the plaintiff to make the lawsuit go away. After that, the company's next step may well be to establish a comprehensive electronic document management policy. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
When companies do spend the money to sort through emails, some turn to Elizabeth Charnock. She's CEO of a company called Ketafora. It sorts through millions of emails for many companies. And a search for corporate information is liable to turn up dirty jokes, health problems, evidence of crimes. Charnock says that's a change from the paper files that people used in the past.
You'd get sued and the guys with the uniforms and name tags would come and clear out your filing cabinet. You wouldn't have personal correspondence of a sensitive nature, for example, in your filing cabinet. You wouldn't put dirty jokes in your filing cabinet.
You now have situations, do you, where someone gets sued because of some stock trading, say, and all this other information comes up, completely unrelated, embarrassing or criminal acts gets swept up and exposed.
Oh, and it happens all the time. People mocking a coworker, and then it comes out as what's known as a hot document in a lawsuit or an investigation. And it's not just egg on the face of the person. It's egg on the whole company. And it can be a career-changing event in a non-positive way.
In a non-positive way. What a great, great way to put it.
And what we see a lot of are huge numbers of emails that have phrases like, delete this email, you know, all in capital letters. Or, don't worry, they'll never know. Or you really don't want to know.
Is it
by
true
the thousands?
And is it true that you can't delete an email? It's impossible.
Unless you're very fortunate, it's impossible. It can get backed up before you know it. It could have been sent to other people. It could be archived without your realizing it. So really, emails are like the cockroach of the electronic world. it's very difficult to get rid of.
And I suppose part of your business is not only collecting this stuff, but helping people to search through it in an effective way. Is that getting easier and easier as time goes on?
Actually, in some ways, it's getting harder and harder because since we've been in business, the average size of an email, I'm not talking about the attachment, but just the text in line, has shrunk by more than 50%. This has a lot to do with all of us who have our BlackBerries and Trios and also the informality of instant messages.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a much more complex problem than you had before because you have to take these little bits and nuggets of content and reunite them to understand a decision-making process.
And who's employing you exactly?
Large corporations, but sometimes smaller ones as well. Individual white-collar defendants, sometimes government agencies.
What kinds of government agencies?
Three-letter ones.
Well, I'm just, you know, thinking about three-letter agencies like CIA, NSA, agencies like that.
There's a great many three-letter agencies.
How many emails could you search in an hour if you applied every bit of capacity you had?
Well, we routinely get collections of over 10 million items, even for very routine cases.
10 million items? I mean, that's anything that it might have crossed a company's desk.
Yes, like, for example, in a particular division that was responsible for the manufacturing of a particular product. They could say, hey, you know, if there's a defect in this, we want to see every email, every instant message, every Word document that anybody ever got, and without the judge necessarily realizing how many millions of items that might amount to.
Do you think there's any limit to how much you can surveil someone through their electronic communications?
If you throw in everything that it's possible to now have, from card key accesses to cell phones to, of course, email and instant message and travel and expense reports and calendars, you'd be astonished by how clear a picture you can paint of behavior. And again, you would not normally do it, but if there's tens of millions of dollars at stake, that's the point at which people start to get very interested in the behavior of the key litigants or actors in the investigation.
Have you ever done a search on yourself?
No.
Anything to find?
Everybody has fits of pique that get memorialized in email. I think that's just human nature.
Elizabeth Charnock is CEO of the software company Catafora. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Okay, I'm on our website here, and we've got some tips on how to email without worry. The summary is don't email, but you can go find the tips at npr.org. And tomorrow our series continues with email and encryption.
This is a story, a very sad tale of intrigue, romance, and electronic mail. A dangerous form of information and the perils of instant gratification.
Well, one thing you can't buy with that rebate check, a break from too much information. This week on Morning Edition, we're focusing on the kind of information overload that comes with emails. But let's say you had to pay to send an email. It's a good bet you'd send only messages that were truly important. And that's the idea of a company called Seriosity. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
There are lots of solutions to email overload now being bandied about. Most are attempts to filter or prioritize stuff once it hits your mailbox. The company Seriosity believes the problem should be addressed at the source, with the sender.
People tend to overuse what's free to them. And right now, email is basically free.
At least free for the sender, says Simon Roy, Seriosity's chief executive. But what's free for the sender, he continues, imposes a sizable burden on the recipient. Seriosity wants to make senders attach virtual money, known as Serios, to every email. And as co-founder Byron Reeves explains, the amount of money a sender has is limited.
You get an allowance every week. You can't ask for more. So you have a scarce resource, and you can use that resource to signal importance to the people you communicate with. But you can't send more than you've got. So you have to think a little bit about how you're going to use this signal, how much currency you're going to attach to information.
Let me start a new message to one of the people in the company, Jonathan.
Simon Roy sits at his keyboard and begins to type a message. He's using the email program Outlook, but the screen has one additional column.
I will tab over to the serial control, which gives me the ability to sign the serials, and I very quickly put in 9 serials. I get to see that Jonathan typically receives 5. So this is a reasonably important message for him. And I will send the message as I normally would. That's it.
And here comes perhaps the most important part. Jonathan can immediately recognize the value his boss has assigned to the email. So he knows if it's something he needs to look at right away or something that can safely be ignored. In this case, Jonathan responds immediately, sending a reply loaded with serios to convey that his answer is also very important. But suppose you send your boss a marketing plan you've created. You think it's great and attach a large chunk of your weekly allowance. But when your boss replies, what you get is a curt thank you, along with just two serios.
You certainly run the risk of getting feedback you might not like.
Seriosity's co-founder Reeves is a Stanford psychology professor. He says getting feedback from the recipient is very important. Seriosity's premise, which is backed by millions in venture capital, is that people within an organization will quickly learn what is and isn't valued by bosses and colleagues. That should make the number of irrelevant or dumb emails decline, and in theory at least, make communication more focused and productive. Will it work? We asked Thad Lyon, an IT manager at eBay's North Campus in San Jose.
I think everybody liked the idea of actually being able to log into their mailbox and actually having a separate column and quickly being able to view, you know, things that were weighted a little bit higher, right? I know I got that way.
Lyon was part of a small test that experimented with an early version of Seriosity's software.
I think that absolutely that had potential for certain segments within eBay to work very well.
Seriosity's product is by no means the only approach eBay is considering, but like so many companies, it has to do something. The cost of information overload and the interruptions that go along with it are staggering. Chipmaker Intel, for example, puts their own cost at $1 billion a year. Once again, Seriosity's Simon Roy.
We don't see the problem, you know, lessening. If anything, it's going to get worse as more and more people come online and they're connected, for longer periods.
Some of the biggest technology firms in the country are now banding together to fight information overload. Just last week, Intel, Google, IBM, Microsoft, and others formed a nonprofit group to study the problem, publicize it, and come up with new solutions. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
And ever hit send and then wish you hadn't? Share your story. We'll post some of them at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Blah.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A proposed merger between Sirius Satellite Radio and rival XM appears to be one step closer to approval. Yesterday, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission threw his support behind the deal. NPR's Felix Contreras has more.
Over the weekend, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin announced he would support the merger of Sirius and XM after the companies agreed to not raise prices for 3 years, to allow all radio manufacturers access to satellite radio technology, and to set aside channels for non-commercial and minority programming. Back in 1977, when the FCC granted the two companies licenses to operate, XM and Sirius agreed never to merge. But the two companies have struggled financially while signing on high-profile and expensive radio personalities to lure subscribers. 17 months ago, Sirius proposed a buyout of XM, and a series of difficult regulatory hurdles began. In March, the Department of Justice ended their investigation into antitrust issues. The matter was then left to the FCC. Now, programming and pricing concessions seem to have provided a breakthrough. While the merger has faced strong opposition from the broadcast industry and consumer advocates, one group that supported the merger was Washington, D.C.-based Public Knowledge, which submitted a proposal to the FCC outlining many of the concessions both companies have agreed to. Art Brodsky, communications director for Public Knowledge, says the group felt it would be more effective to accept the idea of the merger than wage a campaign on behalf of the public interest.
It's sort of a choice between two weak companies, one of which may or may not survive, in which case you'd have one company which would be without any governance at all, without any conditions at all. This way, we hope there will be one strong company that comes out of it and it'll be responsive to the public.
The merger must be approved by the 5-member Federal Communications Commission. FCC sources say the chairman is trying to find at least 2 more votes in favor. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
Here's a reminder that email can be hazardous, and anybody who doubts it should listen to Will Schwalbe, author of a book about email etiquette. Mr. Schwalbe tells us about the autofill feature. You know, you start to type in somebody's name, and the computer guesses where you're heading and puts in the rest of the name for you, or rather the rest of a name for you. It was no help to the company Eli Lilly during a legal case.
Their outside counsel meant to send an email to another attorney working on it named Berenson. And Autofill accidentally provided someone else called Berenson, who happened to be a reporter for the New York Times, and a $1 billion matter that Lilly and their counsel were trying to keep relatively under wraps was handed to the New York Times as one of their great scoops of the year.
We're going to hear more from Schwalbe later. Stories like that inspire us to spend this week talking about email and the way it's changed our lives. And we begin with NPR's Yuki Noguchi, who reports that in a world in which 210 billion emails are sent every day, even the most savvy people can lose control of their inboxes.
You'd think, because Joel Turkus works for Microsoft, he'd have a handle on his email.
In my inbox right now, I kind of laugh when I say this, I've got 2,983 messages. But I think probably one of the things a lot of people get a kick out of is the number of messages that I have unread within my email system, which right now is 31,944 messages.
This despite his system of filtering email by color and archiving them into 450 folders. Here's how he describes dealing with the onslaught.
Email messages that come from my boss or my peers appear as red in my inbox. Email messages that come directly to me, so if I'm on the to line, are green. And then email messages where I typically am copied or on the CC line will come through as blue.
The Ratty Catty Group is a research firm. It studies email and says the volume of it will double in 4 years. But what you're looking at is just the tip of the inbox. Chances are your spam filter is catching a huge number of emails, something like 80%. Turkus says once in a while the overload drives him to extremes.
I have this statement that I'll make sometimes where I say I declare email bankruptcy. I consider it Chapter 11 on email, and I've done it twice since I've actually been to Microsoft. I hate to admit this, but I'll delete my entire inbox.
This doesn't always go over too well with his colleagues. Some send angry notes saying, "Why aren't you responding?" And the answer is, the only alternative is to respond all the time. Here's John Kramer, Vice President for Yahoo Mail.
I think we've all felt that feeling when you come back and the joy of a week away from the office is lost within the first 5 minutes of looking at the emails that you have to comb through.
Basically, taking vacation from email is near impossible. So a number of businesses are trying to set some ground rules, like discouraging reply all messages or declaring email-free Fridays. But habits aren't easy to change. So some technology firms are thinking about how to make email work again. Most companies say there are two basic problems. One, email doesn't filter, so a message you really need to read gets sandwiched between those you might never read. Second, it doesn't organize itself. So some companies are starting to rethink email as a kind of social network. After all, most of us only respond to a handful of people, like family, friends, and some colleagues. Those people make up our core social network. Here's Gabor Chile.
What we're trying to do is figure out how people think about email. And the answer to that is that people think about emails in terms of people.
Chile is vice president of a startup called Zavni, or Inbox, spelled backwards. Its program works by setting up a window displaying the profile of the person you're emailing, as well as their schedule, phone number, and previous emails. It launched last month and has already been downloaded more than 300,000 times. But what about that reply all feature, which generates a lot of mass email? Joel Turkus said he relies on instant messaging to help him cut through the email clutter.
What I found is that these email conversations that go back and forth over a couple of days can be responded to much faster in using instant messaging or voicemail.
And that has cut down on Microsoft's email problem. But technology alone won't solve problems, says Linda Stone. Stone is a consultant who worked for Apple and Microsoft and believes the biggest problem with email is behavioral.
Is email bad? No. Is email good? No. It's how we use it. That's what determines whether it works for us or not. It's really up to us. It's how we use it. It's what we do with it.
And now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go check my email. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Today, NPR begins a new series about email, which too often is becoming a burden rather than a blessing. Many of us have friends or family members who love to forward messages, hoaxes, urban myths, political calls to action. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has this story on the junk mail that comes from your kin.
Deborah Burton has an ongoing disagreement with her 75-year-old father, Clyde Burton. He sends her lots of email.
The ones that I cannot stand are the chain emails. If you don't forward this to 10 people within 5 to 10 minutes, doom and gloom, and you know, you will have no financial luck, etc. So I have asked him to please never send me any chain email letters. But it still does.
Chain emails? But sometimes, you know, they're maybe entertaining occasionally. I may have sent her something like that.
You could say Clyde Burton has a lifelong affinity for mailing things. He was a postmaster in Gloucester County, Virginia for 37 years. He retired and discovered email. He now spends hours exploring the web, where he finds things and sends them along. These include music, pictures, and warnings about computer viruses. The list of recipients, besides his only daughter, is long. He sends them to his best friend who lives an hour away, a brother-in-law who doesn't share his political views, general acquaintances, and neighbors. For a man whose career involved postage and mail carriers, email is like magic.
It's so easy. Double-click your address book and send now, and it's gone.
But what do you do if you're on the receiving end, or if the emails are totally false or make you mad? There's a site that collects hoax letters and urban myths that circulate on the internet. Snopes.com evaluates the truth of the claims. There's a popular email about Democratic presidential hopeful Barack Obama. It claims he doesn't cover his heart during the Pledge of Allegiance, but that's not true. There's another one about robbers using ether-laced perfume to stun victims in parking lots. The site says that's also not true. But aside from basic truth squatting, there's a sticky issue of having to say, I love you, Grandma, but the emails you send are annoying.
Well, it makes it more difficult because it is family, so we're more apt to be more courteous.
That's Diane Gottsman, founder of the Protocol School of Texas. She fields lots of etiquette questions about email, in particular ones from parents directing their children to back a political candidate. Her advice is to call and ask to be taken off their list. And if that doesn't work, she says it's okay to go nuclear.
Filter them out. Block them.
Fighting email with email is futile, she says. It reinforces bad behavior. Email escalated a political fight in Maura Corbett's large family. The exchanges got nasty and caused a huge rift.
When you see them in person at, like, the next family party, there's this weird awkwardness because everybody's kind of gone after everybody else on the email list. But now you're in front of everybody and you're supposed to be nice at like a holiday party or whatever. And so nobody acknowledges it.
Now, with a new election season, she said the family email is again in full swing.
You know, I'm often horrified. People I've known my whole life and have grown up have such radically different views. And in the era of instantaneous information, they can constantly remind me of that.
At least for Clyde Burton, he says often his intention isn't so much to warn of viruses or bother his daughter with chain emails. It's just an excuse to reach out.
I'm probably not a person that would say to Deborah, I love you very frequently. And that's not a good trait. I understand that. But I can tell her that in an email. Why is that?
Why is that indeed? Whatever it is, email seems to liberate us to speak our mind to the benefit and the detriment of our families. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, how the increasing volume of email actually makes us less productive.